Hello, this is Orson Welles, and this is 15 minutes of personal opinion, mine and yours, too. We give you a radio, a five-tube table model made by Lear for any letter we can use. We'll get to that in just a minute.
Nowadays, turning out a radio is far more than assembling a number of parts. To give you what you expect in fine performance requires sound fundamental design, skilled craftsmanship, and familiarity with the newest in radio science. And this is just why you are going to appreciate Lear radios so well. Lear has been building the most exacting type of radios since 1930. They have been aircraft radios, radios that had to be up to the minute in every scientific detail. For 16 years, working like this becomes a habit, so you can expect the same high type of design and workmanship in the Lear radio you can buy for your home. As to the new developments, you may already know about the Lear tape recorder, a new kind of recording that is many steps ahead even of wire recording. Later on, I'll tell you more about it. Meanwhile, just remember, you can expect the finest and the most for your money in a radio that has the nameplate Lear, L-E-A-R. Now, back to Orson Welles.
My apartment was really too cold late last night to work in. Dear landlady, in case you're listening, it's a very nice apartment, no matter what its temperature, and I know how lucky I am to live in it. However, it was chilly, and since my blood is thin by the tropics of Hollywood, I took pencil and paper and went forth to write this broadcast in that climate my poor old battered muse seems to require. I found that climate where I've so often found it before, in Rubens, a sandwich shop on 58th Street. Did I say sandwich shop? Rubens is far more than that. The menu reads like the program of a playhouse, and the proprietor, Mr. Arnold Ruben, that Ziegfeld of the delicatessen, stars his sandwiches in no uncertain typeface. There is, for example, the Carol Bruce sandwich, number 22, consisting of tongue, mustard, and melted Swiss cheese on toasted rye. There's a sandwich named after Sophie Tucker. There's the Colonel J.C. Flippin sandwich and the Tyrone Power. I am personally prejudiced in favor of the Leonard Lyons, turkey, Bermuda onion, hard-boiled egg. And I can't resist mentioning the Orson Welles, a giveaway at $1.10, turkey, India relish, and lettuce. I must say I call it very tactful on Mr. Rubin's part to leave out of my sandwich any mention of ham. Now, this was by no manner of means the first time I've composed a radio show at Rubin's. The place used to be less crowded before the boom, and about that time of the morning when words finally come to my pencil point, I used to sit at the last table on the left and write the letter away with nothing between me and solitude but the occasional sports lover, the casual comedian, the intermittent chorus girl. Writing this show at my old table brought back so many shows I've written there, and I'd like to say that it's always been fun writing them for you and writing them at Rubin's. But my nights aren't always sleepy just because it's cold. I'm living in New York these days and where I've always wanted to live, by the river. The East River, I mean. Morning sun is mirrored on the water and projected again in a wonderful silvery shimmer on the ceiling over my bed, and all night the air is full of the sound of shipping. River sounds, bells and buoys, and the sweet, mournful complaint of steam whistles echoing cozily all the way from the sea reaches to my front door. I've been hoping for such a place as I have now since the first day I came as a resident to Manhattan, or the second day to be exact, when I walked into Alec Wolcott's apartment and found him across a backgammon board from Dottie Parker. There was a good-humored little fire chuckling in the grate. Mr. Toscanini was entertaining on the gramophone, and through the window behind the backgammon game I could see a whole ballet of tugboats. This is for me, I said to myself. I was sleeping at the time on a bed which tilted up and turned into a bathtub in the back room of a basement in the early 80s, and this cost me $6.50 a week. Since then, as they say, my standards have changed, which simply means that I've produced enough plays and movies to worry about the income tax. But frankly, my apartment by the river isn't nearly so grand a place as Alec Wolcott's was. But it's no basement, there's no bathtub under my bed, and the river view is exactly according to the specifications of my fondest dreams. Well, I sat by the window last night before I went to Rubens and watched the boats go by and thought about these things, about basement apartments and river apartments, and I'd like to make public confession of the fact that my thoughts left me with a hangover. Right under my window, a boat puts off every 20 minutes or so on a voyage. Every time it slips its hawser, my heart skips a beat and something inside me slips a hawser of its own. This is that corny thing, the wanderlust, kicking up its old corny stir. The restlessness of the tramp that sent me tramping off in so many directions and on so many far-flung missions and adventures. And fool's errands. But the boat under my window doesn't go very far, just across the river. Then it comes back. Across the river is an island, and it's no Tahiti. It's a place of public hospitals and prisons. They call it Welfare Island. Certainly the boat looks better to the poor wretches watching it across the river from me through the bars. I can almost see the unlucky faces on that island. Straining, and looking at me. Because that is a place where people are in jail. I can actually feel the hard stare upon me, and it frankly spoils my fun. There are so many eyes upon us who have peace and plenty, and only a few are the eyes of the misfits we keep in jails. There are the hungry eyes, millions upon millions in Europe, in Asia, and the slave colonies of our own hemisphere, and it isn't easy to avoid that huge and questioning stare. It's like being in a police lineup. We can't see our accusers, but we hear their breathing in the darkness. I think it's hard to eat three meals a day today without a bit of indigestion. When I first went to call on Alec Wolcott, the world was still a little young and gay around the edges. The war that isn't over yet was brewing then in Spain and China, but it did look for a minute there as though a man could write plays and put them on and enjoy what are called the fruits of success. Even Alec, who was one of the high priests of our American success myth, changed his mind about that at the end, and nobody I know who's worth his weight in fool's cap or grease paint sleeps very well these nights. Me, I've made the East River at last, but I share the general insomnia. Seems there's something called an atom bomb. Seems there's a great fuse wound around the world, and the fuse is lit, and the sound of its sputtering is very loud, and a man or a woman can't sleep for the sound of it. Not without drugs. Before it's too late, we've got to do something. Well, this weekly broadcast of mine is simply one of the feeblest of the attempts. Am I bringing issues to this microphone? Am I helping to clarify those issues? Am I helping at all? I want you to help me to help. That's why I ask for letters. I need your advice, as well as your viewpoint. I've been very frank with you. Now you be frank with me. Well, while the partisans of democracy are dying in Argentina's concentration camps, Nazi agents, among them Ricardo Stout, Ludwig Freud, Fritz Mandl, enjoy the personal protection of the dictator Perón. Government contracts are going to Nazi businessmen, and Nazi scientists are working feverishly on the atom bomb. Says dictator Perón, war is an inevitable social phenomenon. Says your obedient servant. Excuse me, word deleted by censor. Instead of nominating one of these gangsters to the Court of Justice, as we've been suggesting, a police force under the Security Council should depose Perón forthwith and give the Argentine people a chance to set up their own democracy. I don't happen to think they'll get that chance at the voting booths today. Spruill Braden, democracy's best diplomat, has done everything he could to make up for the mistakes Ed Stettinius and Nelson Rockefeller made in the conferences in Mexico and San Francisco. Maybe he comes too late, but I'm a natural-born optimist, and I say he comes just in the nick of time. There's another conference this spring, a meeting of the American Republics in Rio. Braden's blue book may keep Argentina out of that meeting if Argentina's Nazis are still barricaded in the government buildings of VA. Today, you know, our hemisphere Hitler, Colonel Juan Domingo Perón, is pretending to submit to the ballot box. The colonel's mob will supervise all voting, and nobody knows how it'll come out, but everybody's sure that no matter what happens, the colonel won't quit. He's a rabble-rouser, and he has a following. If he can manipulate that following so it looks like a majority, Perón is president. But if it turns out that the average Argentina, who's a good Democrat, can't be hushed up any longer, it's a lead-pipe cinch that the sawdust Caesar of the Pampas won't go peaceably back to Patagonia. He'll stay in power the same way he got here, the gangster way. And the choice in Argentina on this election day is a Perón landslide or a shooting war. And Perón has all the guns. His backers, who were Hitler's backers, make the bullets. They have $7 billion swag hidden away down there in Perón's territory, war profits. And if need be, they'll finance another war to keep it. There's only one real question. If it comes to a showdown, can the colonel deliver the army? Most of the officers of that army come from Argentina's first families. The estancieros, the big landowners, and Perón says he's going to break up those huge estates, and he probably means it. The landowners are sure he does, and they've been fighting Perón in this election campaign, but these same landowners, don't forget, made Perón possible. The government he overthrew was their government, a reactionary, do-nothing administration under which the muscles of Argentina's democracy had grown flabby. There's a lesson in that. Using Mussolini and Franco and Hitler's examples, historians have been claiming that a fascist revolution can only succeed in an atmosphere of social unrest.
but Perón's fascism succeeded in an atmosphere of social cynicism. How well I remember Argentina in that mood of rueful despair. It darkened the streets of Buenos Aires, a kind of spiritual dim-out. There was music and dancing. There were theaters and cabarets and big parties. There was the racetrack and the jockey club and beautiful women and beautiful dresses and beautiful homes. But those of us who visited or lived there in those years found it all very sad, very ominous. Remember, please, the common man of Argentina, the good Catholic common man, was against Franco in the Civil War of Spain. Then why did he sit still for Perón in his own country? Argentina's common man was against Hitler. Then why didn't he fight Hitler? Well, he was weakened by a disease called isolationism and never treated for it by a shock cure like Pearl Harbor. The common man was softened up for tyranny by life under a government he had no part in, a government by a selfish few that would have no part of him. Why don't you do something about it? I asked so many Argentinians, and so many of them answered, what can you do? What's the use? Then one dark night, the colonel's gang took over, and the moral is you don't need to starve a people to make them slaves. You can take their freedom away from them if you take away their belief in themselves. You don't need breadlines to make a dictator, because man does not live by bread alone. Now, your attention, please, for an interesting announcement.
Now a little more about Lear radios and the new Lear tape recorder. This new method of recording captures sound on a magnetized tape. You snap a switch and immediately you're taking down the songs of your children or the jolly antics of friends. Without a moment's delay, you can play it all back. For as Lear uses tape, it does not have to be rewound. What's more, anything you decide you do not want to keep is cleared off the tape simply by recording something else. Along with tape recording, Lear radios will bring you television, FM, shortwave, and an entirely unique remote tuning control. You can select what features you want and a handsome cabinet that complements your home's decor. For there are many styles of Lear radios over a wide price range. Just as fast as we can, we are getting Lear radios into the hands of Lear dealers. We hope that the dealer near you will have them soon. For the one way to see and hear what these new instruments are contributing to home radios is to listen to them yourselves. When you do, we're sure you will agree that the finest radio investment you can make is in a radio made by Lear. L-E-A-R. Now back to Orson Welles, whose views and opinions are his own and do not necessarily represent those of Lear Incorporated.
Dear Mr. Welles, why are returning veterans being taken for a ride and getting photostats of discharge papers? A simple absolute necessity is reaping a harvest for post-war profiteers. In all too many cases, veterans are paying $2 and more for a job that can be done at a reasonable profit for 50 cents. How about it? Sincerely, Florence Monte. Well, vets are being exploited in all kinds of ways. This is by no means the worst, but it's worth airtime to expose this racket, and Miss Monte gets a 5-tube Lear radio for bringing it to our attention. Merchants, associations, and chambers of commerce, please note. Representative Ellsworth B. Buck of New York's called attention to the fact that there's still one commodity in the country of which there's no shortage. Government red tape. According to the congressman, there's so much of it around that a war veteran needing a government loan gets enmeshed in it even before he starts looking for non-existent homes or clothes or business opportunities. I hold in my hand, he asserted the other day in Congress, 17 feet of 6 complicated involved forms requiring some 360 answers and computations. To supply these answers and computations, the veteran would apparently need a tax lawyer, a real estate lawyer, an ex-Washington bureaucrat, and a certified public accountant. A veteran who could afford to pay such a staff would have no need for the loan. Well, it's time to say goodbye now. Please let me come to call again, and thanks for this time. Until then, speaking for my sponsors, the makers of Lear Radio, I remain, as always, obediently yours.
Listen again next Sunday over this same station for Orson Welles, presented by Lear Incorporated. This is ABC, the American Broadcasting Company.